Eric.
Hey, Joss.
How are you doing, man?
Good. How's life?
Excellent. So we're in the C-sharp, one of the C-sharp design room meetings from the old days.
This is from the olden days, yes. When we were having the C-sharp design meetings here for, you know, they have been here for, you know, I don't know, 8-9 years, and now they moved to some other room, but
cool.
Yeah. It's like a lot of old memories here.
And speaking of C-sharp, there's an interesting DSL called Bling that, you know, we're reading about, and fortunately...
Yes, we have the author here, right here, Sean.
Excellent.
You're a native Seattle boy, is that correct?
From Portland.
From Portland. Oops! So, can you tell us where you're now?
Oh, I'm in Beijing, okay. Microsoft Advanced Technology Center.
And so you're working on Bling. So what is Bling?
Bling is
I know it's from like Pimp My Ride and stuff like that, but you know, so you're pimping kind of, you know, the... What are you pimping?
Bling is a DSL for C-sharp and WPF. For
not for VB?
Could be. Not yet.
Okay.
For VB. But basically it allows you to write, to do some cool effects, physical, graphical effects in WPF without having to write a lot of code.
Okay, so and so can you kind of, you know, we have the whiteboard there, so like what is kind of the biggest pain when you are trying to write, you know, these things that you're trying to achieve without your DSL?
So the DSL focuses on three areas. It's data binding, pixel shading, and physics. So data binding in WPF today is a very painful process, right? So you've got to create your binding object. You have to populate it with dependency properties that you want to depend on, and then you have to write this value converter that converts the dependency properties into the expression that you want, into the value that you want to actually compute, right? And all that's very like boilerplate code, right? And so what we do in Bling is that we take expression trees, we traverse those expression trees, and we generate all that code automatically.
So can we do an example on the board? So say, you know, I have like, I don't know, a class person, you know, with, you know, whatever name and age, and I want to data bind that to a UI. So, you know, you don't have to write, kind of, you know, of course, we don't have intelligence
pseudo-code,
and so on.
Yeah.
But just,
or what is Bling syntax?
Yeah.
So this is
good. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, you're lefty.
All right, okay, even good. Better, man.
So we have a label. LBL, right? A little semicolon there. It's not Scala. Now I have a person. Then we can take the label, let's say content equals, I don't know, p.name.
Okay, so this is what you write using your DSL.
Yes.
So where's the magic? So maybe with blue, so, you know.
So in this example, maybe since the name and the age are might be static, it's not showing off the dynamism of constantly changing data. But for example, if this was a slider.
But maybe there's some kind of, you know, somebody else kind of, you know, updating
sure.
the age of the person, right? The person,
sure,
it's like
sure,
the,
sure,
the
sure.
person is aging.
Yeah,
sure.
Father
least,
Time
you know,
usually does that.
At least here.
Yeah.
What happens?
It's working on you, man.
Yes.
What happens is that this instruction, this expression is not just evaluated once when this assignment occurs. It's evaluated continuously. So that if any of these values changes, then the string is automatically recomputed, and the label is automatically updated.
So what is the type then of content?
Content
it's not string
is
then.
Actually object BL, because content is an object. Which this is a string BL. Which is automatically coerced to an object BL.
Okay. So now we're kind of, you know, getting there, right? So now what is this type BL? So now we're kind of, you know, I'm trying to unravel the magic
sure.
here, right?
BL is a brand. We call
okay.
it a brand. Anything with a BL is a brand. Sorry, my handwriting is atrocious. And a brand is a wrapper around an expression. So you could think of a brand as a wrapper around an expression. Expression string. An expression tree of type string.
And so I'm going kind of kind of random here. So but you write in order to create an expression so from a string there. So how do you make sure that you can still create the expression when you're kind of okay, let me just kind of maybe make my question a little bit clearer. So what is the type of this guy here?
I guess that would be string. This would be string BL. Well. So everything has to be in Bling. So the reason why we're not using the normal WPF label and we're using a label BL is because we want the Bling properties. We don't want the normal WPF properties, which are just normal data types.
Okay, so also, so then person doesn't have a name of type string, but that's a string BL.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're only dealing with Bling types here, except... This one, of course, is a constant, and we just coerce it to a string.
Okay, so and you have overloaded, plus yes. and everything.
So
too.
The point of the brand is to provide overloading around expression trees. So the brand will wrap string and provide the concat operator, will provide a coercion from string to string BL, that kind of thing. So that's getting around something in C sharp, which is that you cannot have coercions to generic types. You can't have operators on generic types. Specific generic type configurations. Something that we didn't have in... So originally, I wrote this... This technique was conceived in Scala, right? So we wrote this... We were building a DSL in Scala, and Scala has maybe a more expressive implicit coercion system. However, C-sharp has a more sane system. Say and this is our way of sort of unifying the two systems with brand.
Okay, I can see now. And so where can you said like this thing keeps track of when things change values. Mm-hmm. So where is that kind of magic? So that's not in the expression tree probably. So there's that string BL that must have some other kind of behaviors associated with it to do.
So this is, in WPF, properties, UI properties and properties that are managed, within the UI system are dependency properties. So we can imagine that content is a dependency property, name is a dependency property, and age is a dependency property of int, say. Okay. Now, when you do this manually by hand, you create a binding object. You create a multi-binding, let's say. You say b dot, oh man, I forgot. Add binding. Bindings dot add.
So often I've been wishing for IntelliSense on the whiteboard.
That's coming, man. Intelligent whiteboards are coming.
Sorry, this is going to be wrong.
That's what we want to see. We want to see
showing.
The kind of dirty stuff, right?
Name, property.
But this is the WPF dirty stuff.
Yeah, this is WPF.
Yeah, so this is what Bling kind of...
Then I repeat that again for the age property.
Okay.
Okay.
And then I add a converter. That implements this logic for these two arguments. The converter, my converter, has to be class my converter. Value converter. It's got a really long name. there's a function there called object convert. There's some parameters, which are the dependency objects that you passed in, params, a bunch of other stuff that you'll never use. And you do a return.
And that's all not using generics?
No, none of it uses generics.
It fits in the room, right? They're being kind of transported back in time.
But there is reasons why, because they're doing a lot. This could return a don't change or some other like non proper value.
Oh, okay. So there's
really
like an implicit like a unit a union type.
Yeah, they want monads or something. Yeah. Plus. All right.
Okay.
My horrible code, but there's another function that you don't use. So the point is that you have to remember, okay, this is the first one, this is the second one, 0, 1. You have to write all this stuff out to get this binding. But in Bling, right, you just write this. We walk the expression trees. We generate this. We generate this.
Okay.
So when you say you walk the expression tree, so do you kind of do you generate that class on the fly using reflection emit or something, or what kind of do you generate, or do you kind of interpret the expression tree to?
So we create a single value converter with two function arguments, so a func we convert the value converter into a simple function, which is like object. Sorry. Object. And then we use the DLR to just generate this function, f.
The DLR?
Link DLR.
Yeah.
And that's...
Okay, and then you use that function to create an instance of the converter?
We create a generic converter that takes two functions as an argument.
Yeah. So that's kind of a trick that a lot of people use to kind of, circumvent the fact that you don't have anonymous inner classes in C sharp.
Yeah. But then, we also, in the DLR, we can't create new classes, but we don't need to, because we don't need a new type. So we just need to create a function.
Okay, so you're using link expression trees and DLR kind of to do all this runtime code generation.
Yeah, and then the brands to make it pretty to the C# programmers.
Nice.
So now here's the question. I mean, and this is meant to be annoying, but why do you call this a domain specific language? Because
we call it a lightweight domain specific language, which is even I think less of a domain-specific language than an embedded-specific language. We're not doing any metaprogramming. Well, sorry, we are doing metaprogramming, but we're not doing syntactic metaprogramming here. We're just taking what C# gives us. They give us operator overloading, gives us extension methods. Sometimes when we need to create brands, we have conversions when we need to convert things, right? We're taking what C# already gives us, and we're just creating a nice library.
Yes.
Now, when does a library become a domain specific
exactly,
language?
Exactly, that was my question. That's a kind of... I never understand that. My brain is too small to kind of...
Yes,
that.
And I think the answer is...
Is it just marketing, or...?
Yes, I think any good library will approach a domain specific language, whether it has syntax or not. We just have a little bit more syntax than other libraries, so we're using the term domain specific language to make the other domain-specific language people angry at us.
But stop. That's
okay,
a
good.
Great question,
yeah.
Eric. Let's have this conversation real
yes,
quick.
Go ahead,
what
yeah.
is the difference between a domain-specific language and a DSL? If you're going to... I mean, because, like
and
you
an
said...
an API, you mean. Because
an API, yeah. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, but I think...
What's your definition?
Well, so I think there's, like, people make a distinction between, like, internal and external DSLs. And you know, for an external DSL, I mean, that's clear, right? You write some grammar, you have a parser, whatever.
Yeah.
But for internal ones, I mean, I think these are just kind of, you know, well-designed APIs. I don't know. I think it's just a fancy word for API. I don't know. I mean, that's what it feels to me, which is great to me. I mean, I think, you know, an API is fine with me. I don't see a need to kind of call it anything else. But
interesting. What do you think about that?
I think API design and language design are very similar.
Yep.
So the boundary between them is not, you know, very clear cut. You know, obviously, if you have a new syntax and a new compiler, a new parser, then you can call it a new language. But if you have a new library, do you call that a new language? And I think there is a language in there, even if it's not brought out in syntax. You know, data binding, there is a language for data binding here. You know, it's just covered in a bunch of verbose, you know, verbosity, you know, verbose boilerplate code. Once we get rid of that, we can see the language much more clearly.
But do you see the language, or do you can, you know, in some sense you've kind of fused it into the existing kind of, you know, embedded language, right?
You can write a C# library that does, like, let's say, for example, Haskell monads. It won't look like C# anymore.
Well, but let's go there, right? Because if you look at link, that's kind of, you know, that's monad comprehensions for C#. And, you know, you can write them without, and then it kind of looks kind of ugly with, you know, lots of lambdas and so on. So in some sense, you know, there's like, you know, some syntax added to C#. So is that a domain-specific language? Or I wouldn't say so.
Interesting.
So it's... Yeah, I guess there's... So I benefit from all that stuff already, so...
Yes, yeah. So I think this is kind of, you know, really beautiful and elegant.
It is.
You know, it's. But yeah, I mean, I'm just teasing you that you're kind of, you know, you're riding the current hype on DSLs.
Well, you know, it's an interesting hype, right? I mean, for example, you really haven't clearly explained why link isn't an embedded DSL.
Well, I don't.
It does solve a specific domain set of problems.
I would kind of, you know, disagree with that, because the thing with, I mean, would you say that, like, you know, plus is that an embedded DSL in C#? Because it's like, you know, it's, you can on the one hand say it's a very specific kind of, you know, thing, but, you know, because C# allows you to overload it, mm-hmm. you can use it for anything, like for integers or for these kind of, you know, strange, you know, whatever types that have all kind of magic in there. And the same with link expressions or link queries, uh-huh. you know, because, you know, you can overload them, they are very, they're not domain specific, they're general purpose mechanism that you can then apply to many domains. And that is, in my view, what a good programming language should be. It should, you know, allow you to kind of, you know, use that language to express, you know, all these kind of domain specific concepts inside the host language.
Exactly.
You come from Scala, right? So there, it's kind of, as you said in the beginning, it's much more extreme, right? The way they kind of allow you to overload the language syntax.
You can overload anything, pretty much.
So are there things from Scala that you miss when you were doing this?
It was like the seven stages of mourning, right? First there was anger, then denial, and then you were bargaining, and then, you know, like, just give me this and I'll be happy. And then you were, you know, depressed, and then you began to accept it and just adapted.
Yeah.
I mean, that's six stages.
Yeah, but, and so for example, one of the things that I feel often, you know, that's useful is like, you know, implicit parameters, right? Where, you know, you can kind of, you know, have something that's like in your context that you don't have to pass around explicitly. Is that something, do you agree with that? Is that something you miss? Or?
Sometimes I miss it. I'm adapting. Since I only want that in the code that generates code, I don't worry about multi-threading. So I can conceivably just use statics.
Okay, so you put in a static, because, so otherwise, you know, if you have to deal with threading, you have to kind of pass this kind of boring argument around in all your methods, and
there's always a workaround. Now it does take a while to to get used to that, right? But once you get used to it, it's fine.
And so, like, you know, to kind of continue a little bit on the Scala side, so, like, Scala is also a very sophisticated type system. So is that something where you could say, you know, like, I wish I would have something, you know...
Type parameters. I would love type parameters because I wouldn't have to type out my type, you know, my generic type parameters all the time. So you use a lot of generic... I use a lot of self-types in my library to make all my code generic. The one thing I love in C# that we don't have in Scala is the dynamic, the runtime reification of the type variables. It's been very, very useful.
But that's not really a Scala thing that comes because of it compiles to JVM, right? Where the
yes.
underlying machinery doesn't support
you'd
that.
You'd hope that Scala, if it was running on .NET, would also support that.
Yeah. But now there would be two brands of Scala, so that's it.
Yeah, it's kind of language related. You know, the VM does determine what your language can do, but, I mean, there are obviously a lot of things I miss from Scala, but, you know, you learn to... You know, C# is definitely is a much better than Java, right? So it's, and it's also gotten, you know, it doesn't change so rapidly, and it's more stable. The development tools are more mature.
And so one of the things that I kind of, you know, I noticed when you were kind of doing this is that you made this kind of look nicer and nicer kind of over time, right? When you first did it, there was kind of more boilerplate code that users would have to write. So do you think that you can still, that there are still things where you can say, you know, I can shave off some kind of, you know, ugliness such that it kind of even looks, you know,
sure.
smoother?
So there's a lot of examples. So take, for example, 3D. 3D and WPF is all about these huge collections of points that have specific topologies, matrix topologies, right? Really what you want are a lot of array programming abstractions. So you just add, you know, array classes to Bling, and you start to, instead of having to, like, place all your points strategically in the array, you have an array that you can then, you know, I can map all the elements of the array in one function call, or I can, you know, combine two matrices together of the right dimensions, that kind of thing. And that makes programming easier. So it depends on the problem, but there's always ways you can improve things, and it becomes more specific with each problem.
And so talking about arrays, so one of the things, like, for example, and there I don't know if Scala has that, but, like, if you look at Python, they have all kind of, you know, things to kind of do slicing of arrays and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I could imagine that if you want to do more sophisticated array processing that you would kind of need
yeah.
those things. Is that something that you think you will need?
It's something that we've already needed. So something we've already added to the library.
Okay, and so how would you kind of, you know, write that? So can you give an example, say, what you have to write now and what you would like to write in the
yeah.
ideal case, if you know...
So you might have an array of
maybe we should kind of put
yeah,
in the board.
We should array
the
board,
This is called CLS.
Kind of rewind the tape.
Bling even erases faster than WPF.
Less code, less to delete. Alright, so say you have an array, a 2D array, call it, which is just a matrix, right? Array 2D of double. So we'll give it a brand. Double array 2D. Because brands are, you know, wrappers around generic types that give you operators. Now, the thing about 3D is that, well, everything else, like, you know, in WPF, right, you start, this is zero, and this is, you know, n. Everything grows down. This is 2D. 3D is like this, kind of, with a weird twist.
Oh.
So you have your array, and it's the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So you gotta first of all reverse it, and then you've got to.
Is that because, you know, for 2D they kind of follow the screen coordinates, and for 3D they went to math, or
It's something related to your hand.
Oh, okay. There's, okay.
Hang loose. That's what happens when you hang
something
loose.
Something like that.
Yeah, isn't there something in physics with the screwdriver?
Yeah, exactly. So I came into this problem earlier. My array was the wrong way, basically. Because I have something I'm using for a 2D world, and now I want to add a 3D dimension, a third dimension to it. So I take the array, and we have to flip it. Let's say flip vertical. Not only that, I have to map it because all these coordinates get flipped. It's very hard to explain. I only know the map. Let's say p dot x height minus p dot y. It's a very simple transformation. So this array might come from physics calculations,
okay,
using standard 2D coordinates. Right, and then I have to translate it to support 3D. Okay, now I've got my mesh in place, and I want to add another row up here that's fixed. Now I can just do that by splicing in, say, array equals. Do I call it slice or splice? I think I call it splice. Splice row. And I can splice in my fixed rows up here into my array. And then I can just take that array and I can take the mesh, that positions, one statement.
And so these operations on arrays, are they mutable, or do they create a new array, or?
A bling is a functional model, so everything returns a new value, but actually not value, expression tree.
Okay, so you're not doing anything until you're kind
of. Yes, actually, it's at this point when I generate the code to maintain positions that all the code is generated and dumped to the file. This is just setting up, trying to figure out what kind of code I want to generate. And this is actually determining what code. To you, it looks like I'm transforming values. But actually, no, we're just transforming expressions.
Hmm. Yeah, so that's kind of, a common trick or technique that you're using. So is that also what you're using for your physics?
Well, physics is a bit different. So this is the array programming stuff comes into play for 3D. For pixel shading, it's more of a very, very simple pixel to pixel function. And for physics, you have just abstractions over blocks of physical properties.
And so what kind of, what is your goal with your physics library?
Goal. We want to explore UI physics.
Okay.
So the problem. So UIs are going in multiple directions, right? The graphics hardware keeps getting more powerful. You see all this wonderful stuff in games. You go play the latest, World of Warcraft, or what are people playing these days?
Halo, of course.
Halo. Duke Nukem. Sorry, showing my age. You go play the latest games today, they look beautiful. Then you go use a Word, PowerPoint. It's a huge mismatch in experience. Right? How can we take that advantage?
So you want to, when you're in Word, when you delete a character, you want it to kind of explode? And
we've done that.
I'd like to shoot my PowerPoint, just blow my PowerPoints up when I'm done with them. It'd be awesome.
Why not?
No, but continue with what you're saying. It's very interesting. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt.
So the point is that the graphics the graphics hardware keeps getting powerful, and we have no way of utilizing that in UI. You know, just now, recently, we've gotten 3D and WPF. We've got pixel shaders in WPF now. We can write arbitrary lighting effects and distortions and whatever. We don't know how to use these yet so much in the productive UIs. But we have the technology, and then we can explore how to use them. But they have to be easy to use, right? If they're too hard to use, then people will just ignore them, right? Pixel shader right now, you have to go out, you have to write a bunch of HLSL code. You have to write a bunch of C# boilerplate code to bind to that HLSL code. It's too hard. Most people won't do it. They'll just say, oh, well, that would have been nice, but you know, I got other stuff to do. I got work to do. We make up writing a pixel shader, you know, 10-line affair, the ball game changes. Mm-hmm. Now they only have to think about, well, okay, what kind of pixel transformation do I want? Not what kind of boilerplate code do I have to write down?
Mm-hmm.
Not what kind of language do I have to use? You know, if they're already programming in C#, you know, it's just a matter of, I'll write a pixel shader here. Becomes like a very casual thing. The same thing with data binding. Data binding before, right, it's just too verbose to use casually, right? If you want to do layout in WPF, you're going to use a panel, stack panel, or, you know, it's the recommended way. It's the performance way. But now, with data binding, if data binding is easy to use, you know, if you can use it in one line or two lines of code, another option becomes available. You can do all your layout through data binding, which means that you can do any kind of layout that you can think of mathematically. You can express it in a few lines of WPF code almost verbatim.
So can you drill down a little bit? What do you mean when you say you can do layout with data binding? So suppose, you know, I want to kind of, you know, have, let's say, you know, what is that flow layout or something, right, where you want to kind of, you know, put things next to each other, and if it overflows, you want to put it on the next line. So how would you kind of do that with data binding?
So, we've got our...
Let's kind of clean out the board again.
Clean out the board.
Awesome.
How are we doing for time?
Good.
We're good.
Great. You know, you want to get to the physics stuff. Okay. So we have point BL. We use this as our cursor. And we'll start at 0, 0. Okay, so let's say we have... each of our W in... So we have a list of widgets.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to set... So I'm going to take W dot its position, which we'll say by we'll assign to the left top.
Okay.
Because since we can manipulate all our dependency properties and abstract over them, we can create expression trees. We can create a bunch of properties that didn't exist in WPF. We can create left top, we can create right, we can create center. It's great.
It's awesome.
Whatever we want with dependency properties. Now, I want it to wrap if I reach the end of the screen. So we have a canvas up. We have our parent canvas up here somewhere. BLC. Okay. I'm going to say, well, if at dot x plus w dot width is greater than c dot width. Now, I can't overload question colon, so I have to have a method. Dot condition. Hopefully you guys support question colon overloading someday. Now, if it overflows, I'm going to go to the next line.
Yep.
So I say, okay, the point I'm going to return is going to be 0. It's the beginning of the next line. Then I'm going to take at dot y. And we'll just assume that they're all the same height. Whatever the height of the line is. We can also maintain a max height and add that instead. Okay. Otherwise, it's going to be at. Okay. Now, and then at becomes w dot right. and that's it. That'll do exactly what you want. As the canvas becomes narrower, all this data mining ensures that the widgets begin to wrap around. And I just wrote this today, actually.
Cool.
It's at the top of my head.
And so, just like this is a completely random question, but the condition, should that be lambda expressions there? Because, you know, otherwise that thing gets kind of evaluated too eagerly, or...?
It doesn't matter, because the expressions, well...
There might be side effects in these expressions, or...?
If there are side effects, then... If you have side effects, since it's multi-stage code, right, this code doesn't run until it's evaluated inside the data binding engine. So if you have side effects, you can't express it in Bling. The side effect will run at code generation time. It'll run completely out of phase with where it needs to run.
Sure, but there might also be side effects. You know, I might have like a function that I call here that will return something, and that function might have a side effect. So,
sure.
So you have to be careful with the phasing, you know, especially I think when you're doing this kind of, you know, multi-stage programming in an imperative world.
Yes, it's not something that I've worried about so much yet. Just because the expression trees themselves are already delayed evaluated. So if I have delayed evaluation of expression trees, I'm sort of delayed of a delay of a delay of a delay, then how many delays do I need? You know? And it's not entirely clear that that would be useful yet. Because, you know, yeah, sure, they could have side effects there. But I've never seen it.
Okay, well, yeah, maybe that's because I'm too sensitive for side effects.
Yes, you are. You're shaking over there.
Yes. I'm kind of, you know, I'm nearly crying. But
don't say side effects.
So let's, yeah, since we're kind of, you know...
We're running down on time.
Ryan, let's kind of talk about the physics a little bit. So is one thing that you're thinking about is to really model UI, you know, as physical objects, you know, how should I say? It's like, you know, that when you kind of say click a button, that it kind of, you know, behaves like clicking a real button, or whether you kind of, you know, when you want to do layout, that you have like springs or things that kind of, you know, hold things together like a, you know,
that's
like physical objects.
That's one option. The other two things happening within Microsoft are naturalistic UIs with Surface. Surface is all physics-based, right? And they have very little toolkit support for that physics. They have something called Scatter View in Surface, right? And a richer version of Scatter View would be a richer version of physics. And so we need the UI physics support to support the next generation naturalistic UIs.
So can you kind of tell a little bit more about that? So why, what is kind of the physics in Surface? Is that kind of the multi-touch part?
Yeah, the multi-touch part is you need the physics to interpret the hand motion, to interpret what your hand means when it touches the screen. And then you need the physics to sort of provide realistic output. So the whole point about Surface is that you want to provide a more naturalistic...
So for example, when you spin the globe or something, that it kind of...
spins.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or you push something and it goes across the surface.
When you push it.
Yeah. When you push it.
Depending on how hard you push it.
Not exactly. Necessarily how hard you push it down on the table, because maybe you can't sense that. But whatever it can sense, it wants to interpret that input. You know, we do that via, you can do that via physics. And, you know, provide realistic output also, you know, via physics. Mm. The other direction that we're looking at is cinematic UIs. So we want you want UIs that provide more of an experience where, you know, it looks very it's not completely playful, but it's richer than sort of a form based UI. You know, maybe things pop up, you know, come on stage on cue, you know, entertain you a bit when you're not using the interface.
Then like the Clippy,
or we want to do Clippy.
Oh no,
Clippy 2.0.
Oh no, man.
Exactly.
Wait a second. So that's what you guys are doing in the Advanced Technology Center. Clippy 2.0.
This better not make it on tape. It's totally my job. So, yeah.
That was a joke, Mary Jo. All right, continue.
All right. So the physics stuff is important in a lot of ways, right? You're going to... you're going to see UIs become more and more not like games. They're completely different from games. You want more control. You want more control of the experience. The physics isn't supposed to be challenging in a UI. It has to be nice and friendly and controllable, and it has to go away when you want it to go away.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But you're going to be seeing a richer, you know, richer UI experiences in the future, and that we want to be, you know, and the best way to enable that is through, you know, decent APIs for taking advantage of that. You know, we're not going to have John Carmack writing our UIs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have, you know, capable but not, you know, not star UI programmers doing it.
But does it mean that now all kind of, you know, UI programs need to know differential equations or, you know?
Not necessarily. They have to know geometry, trigonometry, algebra.
But like, you know, what you said in the beginning, right? If I'm moving or waving my hand on the surface, you know, isn't that, you know, doesn't that involve quite a lot of, you know?
We can package a lot of that stuff up into libraries, I think. A lot of the math can be abstracted away. You know, good abstractions for physics is very important so that people, that programmers can use it.
So can we show? Can we be like kind of clean the board and then like have a concrete example?
You like to
make
your victims of expert to expert erase boards a lot, man. What's going on?
Well,
you have some sort of
in physics. No, I like to start with a clean board. You know, it's like the side effect of a clean board.
So in physics, right? We do everything by block. So you have a block of objects. Right, we have this explicit block object called a block.
And with block, you mean a code block, or is that a block that's like a block like this?
A block is, you could think of it as an array, call it a physics block.
Okay.
The reason why is we want to create a dense arrays of these properties, so that if you have an array of, if you have 100 objects, you want the fact that there are 100 objects and you want to lay them out in memory close to each other, right, and their properties. You want to lay out their properties close to each other so that when you do the relaxed loops, right, you have really strong locality. And that means that for now we're doing it on the CPU. In the future we can do it on the GPU if we want because it's completely parallelizable.
Mm-hmm.
And it also provides better results because you're not doing sort of this ad hoc sort of let's update these properties.
So this is kind of funny. That's what I love about programming, right? Is that you're talking about something really abstract, you know, modeling physics, and then at the same time you have to be very careful, you know, to make the implementation run fast. That, you know, that it's kind of, you know, the concrete representation is efficient.
Sure.
That's a fascinating.
However, we have this problem. The physics is a big example. You have the problem that, you know, for doing physics easily, you need really great abstractions. For doing physics effectively, you need really low-level abstractions. How do you solve that mismatch?
Yes.
You know? And the answer is you have high-level abstractions in your code generation before you generate code, and then you generate to a low-level representation. It's easy.
Yes.
So we create a new block, and then we can just abstract over every single body in that block. Using functions here. So I don't want to use a for loop. I'm going to end this loop right now.
So why don't you want to use a for loop?
Oh, because the for loop will execute in C#. We want the for loop to execute.
Okay, so you're doing, this is doing again the same kind of, you know, overloading trick where you can. So, but wouldn't you like, you know, like, this is an interesting thing. It's like, have you kind of looked at F#, for example, where, you know, you can overload kind of the workflows, and there you could kind of, you know, you have more control over what part of the syntax mm-hmm. you reinterpret.
Yes. I'm not really an ML person, so I don't know if that answers all the question, but the point here is that this is really just... this is universal quantification, pure and simple. So we're not really trying to specify a loop. It's not a loop that executes sequentially. This body only gets executed once. But the abstract object that it's executed on represents all the bodies, right? So if I put a constraint on one of the body, on this body, it will affect every single body inside the block.
Okay.
So if I say body dot position, this is the simplest physics example I can do. Relax. Relax because you want to relax. Right? It's a physics terminology. The guard, you have a guard that says the index has to be greater than zero. Right? And I'm going to have a weakening constraint of 0.5, which is like 50%. So whatever constraint I'm going to specify is going to get solved 50% each time step. All right, and then I say body.next. So this is a loop, universally constrained, but each body has knowledge of its predecessor, of its succeeder, so that we can write nice... the one after me. So we write these nice sort of next previous forms. Sorry, this should be because it's greater than zero. Also typos. Okay. Position. Okay. Now, what this means is that I'm going to chase the body that preceded me. So that if I move the first body, then everything will chase it. So it will if I make it like a bunch of circles, right? If I bind the position to a bunch of circles, then the circles will just chase each other. And this is like 50%, so they won't reach each other in one time step. And actually, even if it was 100%, it would still take the length of the chain of the body to sort of catch up. This is a very simple constraint. And it's actually, this one line of code gives you a really nice effect, sort of like a goo cursor. Like if you make the first circle really big, and then you make each successive cursor really small, and then let's say make them all black, and you move them around, you get something that looks like this.
Hmm. Cool.
So. Kind of, you know, going kind of, you know, again, like a random question. So here you write, like, you know, a lambda with a statement. So how often do you run into kind of limitation with expression trees where, you know, this, you know, how can you do this with an expression tree? And when, you know, or...
I don't.
Okay.
Because the expression trees aren't expressive enough to express stuff that I can't process.
Yeah.
So the operations and the brands, okay, I guess I should say, aren't expressive enough. Does that answer the question, kind of?
Yeah, so in general, is there kind of, you know, how do you kind of, you know, do you ever run the fact also that you, you know, sometimes have to use lambda expressions to get the expression trees? Is it kind of smooth enough for you, or
sometimes I have a map that I sometimes resort to. The problem with the map is it only works for code that's going through the DLR. So I can say, like, I have a property of, like, let's say point BL, some random P property. And let's say I just call P.map PP. And this is giving me the underlying point. I do some kind of transformation on that using some conventional C# function. Okay. So this is actually a hack that I try not to use very often because it doesn't work everywhere. If you're data binding, whatever happens inside F is completely completely gone, and there's no dependency tracking there. If you're running in the pixel shader, it will just crash. It will say, I can't handle this, because you can't run F in the pixel shader, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I can run any function that takes blink types and returns blink types, I can run in a pixel shader.
But a link to SQL and link to entities have the same kind of thing, right? If you're using inside your query things that, you know, you cannot translate to SQL or that cannot run, you know,
yeah,
on the other side, that's...
But I think this is useful, and you do use it sometimes.
Yeah.
And actually a lot. And a lot of the last part of Glue Code, we're using it less and less, but, you know, we still have to come up with the right level of abstraction, because sometimes you need to connect just that last part of your physics simulation to your UI. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's an imperative part of your UI, and then you're writing not just with maps, but we have like this assign function. Like we can create an assign closure that does the bind dot assign. And you specify the property, the brand that you want to assign, and you specify the value that you want to assign, and you give it some parameters like T, S, and it gives you back an F that just takes a normal T, a normal S, and you can call that whenever you want to sort of assign that brand.
Okay.
Because otherwise you can't do that normal assign without, you know, generating code each time.
Yeah.
This only generates the code once. So we do have situations where we have to sort of, at that last level in a very complicated project, we have to sort of, okay, we have to do a bunch of these hacks.
Interesting.
But, yeah, I must say, you have kind of pushed the language much further than, you know, I've seen before, so that's cool.
Absolutely.
Amazing. So, yeah.
So what do you think of Bling?
I think we're getting kicked out of the room.
Okay.
So.
But what do you think of Bling? I mean,
well, I think it's beautiful. It's as I said, you know, this is like, you know, kind of amazing feat, you know, to kind of, you know, use the language features, you know, and kind of really push it as far as possible, such that programmers, you know, have an easier job. Mm. That's, I think, what a good library is about, or whether you call it library or domain-specific language. It's the library author takes the pain, such that the library user, you know, gets all the benefits. Yeah.
Excellent.
I think this is an excellent job.
Well, thank you, Sean.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. See you next time, Eric.
Okay.